Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in West Berkeley today. And as always, I am joined by...
From the Montrose in Houston, Texas, Bob Bazanko. Remember to share, subscribe, and like.
Yep. We have a lot of great episodes out right now. We've been kind of really cranking them. So please be sure and check out the Green and Red podcast. In the very least, go to our website, greenandredpodcast.org. Today, we're going to be talking with Jonathan Melrod, who has a book called Fighting Times, Organizing the Front Lines on the Front Lines of the Class War. Jonathan is a radical political activist, a labor organizer, human rights lawyer, pancreatic cancer survivor. But what we're going to be talking, about a lot of things today, but we're really going to be talking about the period that Jonathan writes about in this book, which is being a radical labor organizer in the 1970s in Wisconsin and cities like Milwaukee and Kenosha. But Jonathan, welcome to the Green and Red podcast.
Great. I mean, I'm really glad to be here. And, you know, I got an opportunity to check out your background and webpage, and I'm, you know, really pleased that you asked me to be here.
We really enjoyed the book and are really looking forward to talking to you about it.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Maybe we can actually, I'll start off with a question about the book. Is that you have a very storied resume. I guess you could say you have a very storied life, but the book is very focused on this period of the 1970s where you did all this radical labor organizing in, you know, factories in Wisconsin and Milwaukee and Kenosha. And I'm wondering if you could actually just talk a little bit about why the memoir is like really focused on that. Why did you choose to kind of go with that?
Yeah, I mean, there were actually two reasons. One reason was that in 2004, I was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer and only given 6 months to a year to live. And I had young kids, 7 and 10 years old. And over time, they kept asking me, Dad, you know, they understood that the cancer was linked directly to industrial toxins, particularly trichloroethylene, tanning solvents, you know, things like that that I had been, you know, exposed to on a regular basis in the factory. And, you know, they kept saying, Dad, you know, why couldn't you have just done what other fathers do, like be a teacher or, you know, be an accountant or be a lawyer? You know, you're looks like you're gonna leave us. And, you know, why did you have to go that route? And I realized that if I didn't try and leave behind something that explained to them why I did what I did and why I was willing to make that sacrifice that I knew I was making at the time. I mean, if you look over at a barrel of trichloroethylene and it's got a skull and crossbones on it and management is telling you to dip rags in it and wipe down the body of cars to get the grease off them, well, you know that it's pretty dangerous. And we fought the company to get rid of it, and they could have replaced it with something a bit more expensive, and they didn't. And I made the choice that most working people have to make, which is you got to make a living. So you're not able to walk off the job and say, okay, you know, I'll take a pass fail on that class. So I decided I had to write it for that purpose, to, you know, leave behind an understanding for them and hopefully my grandchildren, which don't seem to be coming along very fast, but but maybe. And but the second reason was that I started writing it. Well, I really got into the writing of it when COVID broke. And I basically said, if I don't write it now, when I'm already isolated in the house, I'll never write it. So I spent 2.5 years every day from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. working on the book, on Saturday and Sunday as well. And that's really, it became a passion. And I wanted to get it done so that I could share it with young new organizers that are going into the labor movement, that are organizing in communities. And I felt that it had something that I could inspire them with and show them and answer a lot of questions. You know, are racist white workers always going to be racist? Or can you work with them and build alliances? You know, lots of important questions. Can you reform big unions like the UAW? And we fought for this one member, one vote, where the membership elected those who go to the convention back in the 83 convention. And we won it finally about 2 years ago. So, you know, I was able to explain to people in a way that I think was very anecdotal. And you can comment yourselves, but I tried to make it funny. I never took myself overly seriously. But people have said that they find it a great read. And I'm all of a sudden, I'm leading study groups about it. I was just contacted by a socialist group in New Bedford or somewhere. And they said, we've been reading your book every Sunday. And would you be willing to attend the last reading on the 31st of March and discuss the book with the people we work with? And I mean, I said, absolutely. That's what I live for at this point, is passing on the knowledge that I was able to gain to younger people to inspire them and to provide them lessons and how we were able to do things back in those days.
Before we continue on that, I want to kind of do a little background, because it's fascinating. You were in Madison in the early 70s, which if you study like the kind of stuff I do, is really a big deal. And that's where you see this convergence of the Vietnam anti-war movement and other movements. And I think you said that you wore a Vietnam button to work one day, not really sure the reception you'd get, but it was actually quite positive. So do you want to talk to us? And I believe you were there when the Army Math Research Center was exploded too. So you want to talk a little bit about how that time in Madison kind of led on to bigger things like labor organizing?
Yeah. I mean, I chose to go to school in Madison because I always feel, and most of the people from Madison feel, like we really were the exemplary campus in terms of political radical activity. Yeah. And SDS, but of course, people at Berkeley would dispute that and what have you.
Ann Arbor,
those are the three, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But, I went there for that reason, and this is kind of wild. I was in line back in the days before computers where you had to sign up for classes. So you'd be dashing from one line to the next, trying to get your freshman classes. And I got to the end of the registration period, and they informed me that I would take mandatory reserve officer training classes once a week for 7 weeks, obligatory. And I was a bit flabbergasted. I never was, prepared for the fact that I would have to go to a reserve officer training class as part of my curriculum. So I met, there was an SDS meeting, Students for a Democratic Society, which was the largest student organization, about 100,000 students at that point in high schools and colleges across the country. And at that very first meeting, we talked about fighting ROTC as a campus manifestation of the Vietnam War, because those ROTC classes were training people to become the second lieutenants that would then be in Vietnam, in the jungles, telling the rank and file grunts what to do and when to attack. And it was part of the war machine. And we decided we were going to attack every institution on campus that had direct ties to the Vietnam War. And so I was designated, being an activist already in high school, to be the person who got up and challenged the second lieutenant who was running the ROTC class. And it was literally the first week of school that I was there, and I prepared myself and I got up in the middle of his lecture and I said, I have something to say. And he was shocked and the class was all watching what's going on here. And I said, I want to talk to you about the Vietnam War from a different perspective. And I had really done my work. And that's a lesson for everybody that who's active in the movement, you got to do your background research. You got to be able to really talk from a position of knowledge. And I started saying to the second lieutenant, I said, look, the French were thrown out of Vietnam in 1954 in Dien Bien Phu, and the United States has now stepped in as another colonial power trying to rule Vietnam. And inevitably, we're going to be kicked out like the French were. And you're training young Americans to go over there and risk their lives for an imperialist war. And we don't believe in that. And I'll tell you one other thing. And he fell for the bait. He said, what is that? And I said, the reason so many second lieutenants are being fragged, that's killed out in the field, is because soldiers don't want to fight. And they're tired of being used as a pawn in a rich man's war. And in the end, it was soldiers who refused to fight, who had 220 underground newspapers opposing the war on bases, coffee shops, all over the country, that really ended the war, that really said to the ruling class in the United States, you can't fight a war with soldiers who go out 100 yards and light up a spliff and smoke pot and then wait till the sun goes down and go back to the base. And that's what was happening. So then after I had said all that, we staged a walkout, and you know, probably 30 or 40 of the people in the ROTC class walked out with us. And there were probably 100, but that was the beginning of really building that movement. And from that very act, the student, whatever the legislative body, voted to kick ROTC off campus. The freshmen voted to kick ROTC off campus and to make it non-compulsory. And the university was forced to do it in the first couple of months, which was very invigorating to feel like we had the power that we could accomplish that, you know, and that sort of set down our marker, which was we had to build a very educated student body that understood why we had three particular demands around the Vietnam War. One was to get rid of the Land Tenure Center, which was a center that did studies on how to conduct anti guerrilla warfare in the Third World. And in fact, they did some of the research that led to the death of Che Guevara in Bolivia, one of the leaders of the revolutionary movement from Cuba, who had then gone to fight in Bolivia. And we also opposed the Army Math Research Center, which is what you, Robert, have brought up. And there was a member of the student newspaper, the Daily Cardinal, that did some phenomenal research where he was able to tie the Army Math Research Center in Madison to the Michigan
program, the MSU advisory group.
Yes, that was doing work openly for the military. So he sort of worked his way back to discover what the Army Math Research was doing. And it was doing studies on if you were to drop a bomb on, quote, ants, and there were 10,000 ants, how big a bomb did you need to drop to make sure you killed all the ants? And I mean, this was all direct war research that was being utilized by the military. So we have three demands that came out of the SDS first couple of meetings in 1968, when I got to Madison, which was ROTC off campus and get rid of the Land Tenure Center and get rid of the Army Math Research Center. So, you know, we focused a lot of marches constantly on Army math. We put out literature. We'd go into the dorms three nights a week. That was my assignment in SDS. And we'd go from room to room, knocking on the door. Can we come in and talk to you about these three demands? So we really educated the student body. And, you know, I was out in Oakland in the summer of 1969. I was checking out one of the organizations then that was beginning to develop a national presence, the Revolutionary Union. And I got a call at about 3 in the morning. And they came and woke me up and they said, you know, somebody needs to speak to you on the phone from Madison. And I picked up the phone and I could hear the tone in their voice. John, you got to get back to Madison. Something's happened. There's been a graduate student who died in a bombing of Army Math Research Center, which was really an unfortunate tragedy and definitely an unintended consequence. I mean, the kids who had blown up the building, and they were just kids, 19, 20 years old, had really done their work of surveilling the building, you know, what the schedule of when people were there. And there were never people there at night, but unfortunately on that night, this one graduate student had been doing research and he was unfortunately killed. But that was sort of the pinnacle of the anti-war movement. Because after that, they brought in the FBI, 100 agents, and they really swamped the campus and the student ghetto area where we all lived, going door by door, you know, trying to solicit any tidbit of information to find out who had been engaged in that bombing, which took them years and years. And one of them still has never been found.
The Carlton brothers?
The two Armstrong brothers.
Armstrong.
Yeah, one of whom did a lot of time in Green Bay Prison. And interestingly enough, a girlfriend of mine who worked at a GM plant in Milwaukee, her future husband, after we broke up, was in jail with Carl Armstrong. His nickname was Boom Boom because of the bombing. And he was teaching a study group on Marxism. And this ex-girlfriend, her then boyfriend, was in that study group. So even when he was in prison, he continued to be an activist. Yeah.
My next question is a little bit into the sort of next phase, I guess you could say, is after you were a student militant at University of Wisconsin, then you decided to move up the road to Milwaukee and become a rank and file worker. I'm wondering if you could talk about how you made that decision and where you went and what job you got and that sort of thing.
Right. You know, I do have to step back a bit to Madison because the roots of my decision to go into the factory really came out of the student movement. You know, the first time that I really had experience working and organizing with the working class was in the summer, I believe, of 1970, or maybe it was earlier than that. But I had seen a poster on a telephone pole that said, "Come here, Jesus Salas, leader of the Obreros Unidos Union that's organizing farm workers and cannery workers throughout the state of Wisconsin." And I went to that because I had already been educated to the boycott of grapes that had been initiated in Delano, California, where there were 22 strikes at grape vineyards to demand recognition of the United Farm Workers Union. And I went to hear Jesus Salas talk about the conditions in the fields, no bathrooms, no water breaks, no breaks, and the spraying of dangerous cancer-causing chemicals as workers were in the fields. And I became part of that movement. And I spent one summer for about 3 months driving Jesus's brother Manuel around Wisconsin. We were organizing, there'd be a wildcat in a cannery and we'd go up there and there'd be some Brown Berets, which was a radical Latino organization, Chicano organization that had developed, and they had led a walkout and we'd be talking to them about the union, trying to get them to be organized as part of the union. So I had a background, you know, in looking toward working class people as, you know, those who were really fighting the system, not in the same way we were on campus, but they were challenging the class system. And the next experience that really kind of settled me on the direction I was headed was that in Madison, there's something called the School for Workers. And that is a labor school. Workers from union factories all over Wisconsin come there for a week to study labor history and contract enforcement. And it's a really great program. And they asked us to come speak from Obreros Unidos. And we were speaking to a group of steel workers. And when we walked in, I got to admit, I was like, had been a long-haired hippie in high school and, looked at anybody over 30 as untrustworthy. So we walked into this class of about 40 steel workers, and I was like, oh shit, I'm in the wrong place. I mean, everybody had a crew cut and wore their nylon United Steelworkers jacket and, had a, what we used to call, they used to call it in Wisconsin, a beer tumor, which was a big belly hanging over their belt. And we talked about this, we talked about the farm workers' strike and the boycott of grapes. And at the end of it, one of the guys put up his hand and he said, I make a motion that we go on Friday with Brother Salas and Obreros Unidos to picket Kroger's grocery store because they're carrying scab grapes. So that Friday, we went out to the picket line, and part of his motion is, boys, let's show them how we put up a picket line. So we're out in front of this Kroger's, and they're chanting and they got signs, and we're walking in a circle. All of a sudden, they all march into the Kroger's, 40 of them. And they fill up shopping carts with ice cream on the bottom. And they've got them overflowing with groceries. And they get to the checkout counter and they all leave them there and just walk out. And they walk out singing Solidarity Forever. And there was this one verse in Solidarity Forever that really turned me around in a lot of ways. And it said, we shall bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. And I said to myself, damn, that's pretty radical stuff. That's, I can really get into that. And that's what said to me, that's where there's the power to really change society in the working class. And that we can't just make a revolution on the campus. We can't just organize on the campus. If we were really going to make a difference and a transformative type difference in society to change it from a, capitalist exploitive based system into something that was more equitable, more just, more fair, and I like to call that socialism, then we'd have to go into the working class and win people to that message. So there was an organization at that point, SDS had broken up, and it was Revolutionary Youth Movement 2, which was one of the larger groups that came out of SDS. And we operated on two basic principles that we all united on. One was that after we left Madison, we would either go into the military to organize against the Vietnam War, or we would go into the factory to organize workers, and that we supported the Black Panther Party. Because at that point, there were some people on the left that had called the Black Panther Party nationalist, not revolutionary enough. And we really felt strongly that we had to make a statement that the Panthers were the ones sort of leading the struggle on the cutting edge of taking on the system. And they needed support, broad support throughout the society. And, when I got time to leave, I, like about 30 others from Madison, went to Milwaukee, and we all went into factories in Milwaukee, probably about six or seven factories. At that time, we were all members of the Revolutionary Union, and we began organizing. And the first place I went into was a really low-paid, primarily women's factory. And the union, excuse me, the union wasn't that strong there. And one of the first assignments I had was I had this straw boss who was a Latino guy. And he said to me, Juan, I got one of the bestest jobs you can do today. And I'm like, okay, what's up with this? I can see the smile on the side of his mouth. And he says, Juan, your job is to get down to the vata, the vat. That's this big 6 foot by 6 foot concrete vat, and clean out the trichloroethylene pellets that have settled to the bottom. And I'm like, whoa, where's my PPE? Where's my breathing gear? And he says, John, that's for sissies. We don't need that. Do you? And I'm like, okay, this is like going into a fraternity. It's your first hazing experience. And I, you know, I said, all right, people got to do this. Other people did it. So I get into the vat, and about 30 seconds later, I'm literally gasping for breath. My head's spinning. I'm nauseous, and I jump out. And for the next, I'd say 20 minutes, I was like a leapfrog going in and out, trying to get fresh air. You know, when I looked to the side of the vat, it was trichloroethylene in a big barrel, 50 gallons with the skull and crossbones. And I said, you know, this isn't healthy, but if I'm going to be, you know, an organizer of the working class, I got to deal with the conditions that people deal with every day to keep their families alive. But I wanted to move on to a factory that, you know, was a lot larger and a lot more important in the sort of industrial landscape. And I kept hearing stories about these radical rowdies at American Motors. Now, for younger people who listen to the podcast, American Motors was the fourth largest auto company in those days under Chrysler. And in 1969, I had read, going back to do some research on American Motors before I went to work there, that between the Kenosha plant and the Milwaukee plant, there had been 12 wildcat unsanctioned strikes in 1 week. That means every time they'd go out, they'd settle their grievances, they'd go back in, there were more grievances, they'd wildcat and go back out again. And I said, damn, that's where I want to be. So that's where I got a job. Me and hundreds of other young people, it kind of felt like Woodstock atmosphere. I mean, everybody had long hair, you know, the black guys had big afros. There were a lot of black women who had, you know, young women who were church women who became very important to the first caucus that we founded. And a lot of young white guys who were still wearing bell bottoms and platform shoes the day they started work. So, you know, I just felt like I was right at home. And it wasn't that a big a transition. People say, well, how did you manage to go from the being a campus, you know, on the student on the campus to working in the factory? And it was like, hey, it was not a big deal. You know, I mean, if you're just natural and act natural and do your job, you know, people accept you. And it was a period of rebellion. I mean, at the Lordstown plant, they were, I mean, it was rebellion, you know, all the time. They had trouble controlling the young workforce. It was famous for the fact that it was so rebellious. So it was a period of real, you know, struggle in the factories all over the country.
Actually, that's a great segue. I want to follow up on that. You just mentioned the spirit of that time. You mentioned the dozen wildcat strikes in Wisconsin and the Lordstown strike, which is right near where I grew up, and yeah, Drum in Detroit. And I think people kind of laugh now about, you know, kind of, oh, these people thought they were radicals or whatever. But in the moment, there was a real sense of like consciousness there, wasn't it, that you guys could take on the bosses, take on these automakers. And, you know, I think it was widespread. If I, you know, when I talk to people, you know, from the Youngstown area, Lordstown, and that, they kind of spoke the same way you did about the spirit of those times and the sense of possibility, which, because today is pretty bleak and you don't get as much of that. So,
yeah, I mean, well, it's important. The group you mentioned is really important. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which at Dodge were Drum and at Ford were From, and you know, on and on. And they really, you know, they were about challenging the whole system, you know, about considering black workers as a revolutionary vanguard in the factories. And the UAW International, in league with the companies, came down, you know, like a, you know, punch press that can knock out hoods of a car. I mean, they went after every one of those guys, you know, because they led some wildcats and they aligned with Arab American workers. Interestingly enough, I believe it was 1973, if that sounds right. The Arab American workers had demanded that the UAW divest itself of Israeli bonds. And they had allied with the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and they shut down a number of factories in wildcat strikes and were able to get a number of local unions to divest of Israeli bonds, which is almost freaky in that it's like a repeat of history. We're trying to get the unions again to divest. And some of them have pulled out of pension funds that hold Israeli bonds, which I think is a really inspirational, you know, because you're right. there isn't the sense of rebellion, but there is a really growing sense of rebellion. The number of unions that have condemned what's going on in Gaza and have called for a ceasefire is really quite significant. But, you know, even, you know, there were a lot of Korean War vets at American Motors, and they were pretty politically backward. I mean, they had really been brainwashed, you know, by the sort of military industrial complex to be gung-ho America first, no matter what. And, you know, they weren't happy with what we were doing, even when we were first organizing at American Motors. And the first action that we took was that we used to have Saturdays off, and we were all young. So that was our day to party Friday night, sleep in on Saturday. And they came around and on a Thursday, and management told people, we're scheduling Saturday for work. And we were like, whoa, you know, this is really going to fuck up our Friday night. And, you know, and who wants to work on Saturday? For those days, we were making pretty big money. And I went home and I found this copy of the contract, which you couldn't even get from the union, which was really is endemic to what the problem with unions are, that they don't really look at the membership as being who is the union. So you can't get a copy of the contract. But I found where it said that all overtime is voluntary. So I went to run off a Xerox copy, which for those who don't know what a Xerox is, that's like going to the Sprint or the copy center. And these young guys that I had gotten to know, guys, and by the way, in Wisconsin, or probably in Michigan too, when we say guys, it's men and women. So, you know, we all handed around this page from the contract. So on Friday, when the company came around officially to notify people, they bring a steward because foremen were not allowed to talk to workers about anything that had to do with their work assignment without there being a steward present. Just to digress for a moment, we had one steward for every 35 workers on the assembly line. And that steward only had to work a half hour a day. So we had 300 stewards just in that one plant. So you can imagine that when the union was strong and militant, that was a real shop floor, you know, work, you know, leadership that really took their job seriously, because elections were every year, so that you got thrown out the next year if you weren't standing up for people. But in any event, when they came around on Friday to notify people, all you could hear was people, I ain't working on Saturday. Saturday's my day, you know, and everybody basically turned it down, which was a great thing for two reasons. One, there was a collective feeling that we'd stuck together and we had won, because the company came around and notified everyone. Well, due to some people not wanting to work and giving other people the opportunity to make extra overtime, we're canceling Saturday. But there was a very important union principle involved. That principle was, if there's workers who are unemployed, we shouldn't be working overtime. We should be bringing in unemployed workers. An injury to one is an injury to all. We need to protect each other. Now, we're beginning to get back to more of that in the UAW with the new leadership, the reform leadership that's been elected, that sense of camaraderie and looking out for each other. But after that, the guys who were the Korean War veterans sort of came after me, and they told me that I was going to end up like Roy Webb. And I didn't know who Roy Webb was, and I checked with some other people, and he was a steward during the Korean War, and he had been passing a petition opposing the war, saying that this was just a police action the United States had got involved in, and we shouldn't be involved. And the next time I was out in front of the gate handing out a flyer, the same group of guys who were Korean War vets dumped a bucket of cleaning fluid from the fifth floor onto my head. So, you know, I got a little toast of not everybody's with me, and that you're going to have to work to change people over time. And ironically, later on, when I was elected to the executive board and the bargaining committee, all those former Korean War vets were all in my camp, voting and campaigning for me. you know, that was 13 years later, but they had seen that, you know, as radical as I was, as willing as I was to stand up to the company and take bold stands, that they would vote for me because I was a fighter and I was a militant.
You know, you did a lot of this organizing through the Fight Back Caucus within yeah. the factory, and a lot of radical organizing going on there. And you talk about being targeted by the FBI, and you talk about being targeted by the bosses within your own union. I'm wondering if you could talk about that sort of backlash reaction that was happening to your radical organizing.
Yeah, the one party you've forgotten is the International UAW.
Oh,
because
yeah.
It was like a tripartite, you know, of the international and of management and then the FBI. What happened was that the company announced a speed up, 3 more cars an hour with no change in our work assignment. So for anybody who's ever worked on an assembly line, adding 3 cars an hour is a lot. It's remarkably how much work it adds to your job. And we got together with some of the young people who I referred to earlier that had gotten active around fighting the overtime. And we had our first official caucus meeting. And it was mainly Vietnam vets of color, one Puerto Rican guy, a number of young Black guys, good sized group of young Black church women who had that feeling of community and sticking together. And they brought that into the caucus. And then me and, just a couple of white guys to begin with. And we said, we've got to learn how to fight this speed up. So let's put together a flyer. So we wrote a flyer that said, you know, fight speed up, walk, don't run. And we quoted the contract that said you're only required to work at a normal pace. So we repeated that. We said, we're not racehorses on a track. We're humans, and we're going to work at a normal pace. Well, that one flyer started a firestorm, because what happened was the senior workers, the workers that had built that union and were militants, the ones who had been wildcatting in 1969, woke up. And they showed us how to fight speed up, which was called riding the line. That meant that you would do your job with the additional work as long as it took you. So you would drift out of your workstation into the person next on the line's workstation. And you'd push them so far down, they couldn't finish their job. And so they couldn't put a trunk rubber on. And if they couldn't put a trunk rubber on, the person putting taillights in couldn't put the taillights in. So meanwhile, everybody's throwing their parts into the car, and they're pulling the cars off the line and just throwing them in a repair hole and then filling the roof with cars. No cars were getting built. So we held another meeting that night, and we said, let's up the stakes. Let's make our own t-shirts that say fight speed up on a big red stop sign. So we got the equipment. You know, you couldn't go get somebody to run off your t-shirts in those days. We got a squeegee and a silk screen, and we kind of learned how to make them. And the next day, the 25 we made sold out. So we said, hey, we're on to something. And we stopped again, and we made the 100, 150, whatever. They sold out. Well, now the company's starting to freak out. And they come around, they notify everybody that day. Anybody wearing a t-shirt tomorrow is going to be discharged. Like we did to the Black workers who wore Black Power t-shirts 3 or 4 years ago. And I got a little bit nervous. I mean, you know, I said to myself, you know, there's a lot of people with a lot of seniority here. And, you know, you got to really think this thing through about, are you putting their jobs on the line? And all of a sudden, my steward comes up and he says, I want a t-shirt tomorrow. I'm wearing it in. The chief steward came up and said, I want a t-shirt. I'm going to wear it in. And the vice president of the union came up and ordered a t-shirt. And the word spread that there were that faction of leadership that were willing to stand with us. And that was really an important lesson for me, because I had kind of come in with the attitude of everybody who's in the administration is a sellout. And again, anyone over 30, you know, is a sellout. But there were these members of leadership who were willing to side with us on that issue. Didn't mean they were going to join our caucus. Didn't mean they were going to be out at the gates handing out flyers with us. But it did mean on a tactical basis, they would join with this fight against SPDA. And that brought in hundreds of more workers, you know, and the next day the company caved in, took work off everybody's job, and hired an additional worker for every section on the assembly line. Again, bringing more workers in. Of course, then the word went out that Melrod is a Black Panther, Melrod's a radical, he's a communist, you know, and the international wants to get rid of him. And the president of the local, Bernie LaPinka, has put out the word he's going to get fired. So it was just a matter of days before three or four security guards came up and literally dragged me out of the plant because I refused to move. And a lot of the older workers were yelling to sit down to save my job. But the stewards had been notified by LaPinka, the president, that they weren't to interfere. So I was fired. And I don't want to go into the long details of it, but we had the right to strike over every grievance. And the older workers really came to my defense. They put out flyers on their own that called for people to come to the union meeting to vote to strike to win my job back. And we actually won the vote. And the president of the union took the clicker that was the counting thing, threw it down on the ground. And, you know, he says, "Dad, this damn thing is broken. Let's do it by voice vote." And then, you know, you're not going to win a voice vote if you've been set up. And we looked back in the back of the room and it was lined with cops. So, you know, they had really prepared to make sure that I lost and I was fired. Well, later, years later, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI. And after three or four appeals, I got my full file. And for people who are interested, it's up on my website, a couple hundred pages of it. My website is jonathanmelrod.com. And the FBI, no, American Motors, had gone to the FBI as if they were their own private detective agency, which really shows you the collusion between government and industry. And the company had asked the FBI, "What should we do about this guy, Melrod?" And the FBI had sent them a memo, which is up online, that said, "Fire him, don't ever rehire him. There's people in six or seven other factories putting out the same kind of literature. They're all members of the Revolutionary Union. And they're, you know, we got to get them out of these factories." So, you know, they fired me, but when they hauled me out, I looked back up at the five-story plant and I said, "Motherfucker, one day I'm going to walk back up these stairs. I'm going to show you." And sure enough, about 2.5 years later, the National Labor Relations Board ordered me rehired. And when I came back into that plant, I had made a sign on cardboard that had a blown up picture of my back pay check. And I walked down the assembly line holding it up like a boxer who had just won a title fight. And the people went wild on the line. I mean, everybody loves David beat Goliath. So even if they didn't support my politics, you know, they love the fact that I had got a back pay check and I had kicked AMC's, American Motors' butt. No matter all the lawyers they had, that I had been able to beat them. And it was a great victory. And, you know, from then, you know, we later got moved to Kenosha, where we rebuilt another caucus right away and sort of continued our organizing.
You are listening to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button. And if you're listening to us on your favorite audio platform, please give us a rate and review. It helps us with the algorithms. And if you really like what you're hearing, please go to our Patreon, patreon.com/greenredpodcast, and become a patron or make a one-time donation by going to our website at greenandredpodcast.org and hitting that support button.
You also had a run-in with the police at the time, kind of similar to what you just talked about. You were robbed, I guess, and they came. They were initially sympathetic until they saw who you really were.
Well, you know, I, when I my job in Madison, I worked with the Black Panther Party. And actually, the first time I showed up on the FBI's radar was in 1969. They traced a telephone call from my apartment to the Black Panther Party office in Chicago, where I was arranging the delivery of newspapers, Black Panther Party weekly paper. We used to sell about 350 in Madison every week. And I was kind of in charge of the team that would sell them. So that's when I first ended up, got on the radar. And I continued to sell the paper when we moved to Milwaukee. We worked with the Black Panther Party in Milwaukee. And I, you know, just being a student out of school, I, you know, didn't have enough money to, I mean, I had to live in a pretty poor area of Milwaukee that was primarily a African-American neighborhood. And one night I, not one night, one late afternoon, I came home from work and the apartment had been robbed and the TV was lying in the doorway. And I said, well, you know, this is probably a drug addict who's going to come back and try and get what he left. And I put a shotgun under my bed and I was, you know, couldn't really sleep. And 2 o'clock in the morning, I heard the window to the dining room break. And I got up and I confronted him. And it was one of the worst moments of my life because, I mean, when you're actually faced with someone's life, it's a very scary thing, you know? And I didn't want to take somebody's life for stealing a damn TV, you know? On the other hand, I was nervous. I didn't know if he had a gun or not. And I just chambered a shell in that shotgun. And I said, look, brother, just don't come in this window because neither of us will be happy about it. And he took off and he left. So I felt like I needed to call the police to put on record everything that had been stolen so at least I could get my insurance for it. And the police arrived and they're all big. I mean, the police on the tactical squad in Milwaukee were at war with the Black community. They used to drive through the Black community with long guns hanging out the windows just to intimidate people. I mean, it was really a war zone. And they just went after the Panther Party. They had arrested three of them, Jesse, Booker, and Earl, on attempted murder on a cop. And they were innocent. They ended up getting convicted and did about 17 years each in jail. I think if they were in now, they would have been in there for the rest of their lives. But in any event, when the cops get there, they're like real buddy, you know, white guy, you know, yeah, we're going to find who this is. And they're out in the backyard with their flashlights, you know, looking in the bushes, you know, to see if they can catch somebody. And then they saw this stack of about 200 Black Panther Party newspapers, and they're each pointing over at it. And it's on the cover is a picture of Huey P. Newton sitting in this wicker chair with a spear in one hand and a shotgun in the other hand. And I see them all whispering to each other, pointing at me, and they all sort of gathered together, took off and left. And said, yeah, that was it. They didn't want anything else to do with me because the fact that I was supporting the Panthers was trumped their racial ties with me. So that, you know, that was, you know, and after that, they continued to, you know, harass me. I mean, there was one incident where they stopped me in the middle of the winter in Wisconsin, which, you know, from living in Michigan, how cold it can be. And they told me to get out of the car and put my hands on the back hood and told me to take my gloves off and get my driver's license out, which I did. And I went to put my gloves back on because it was about 10 degrees and you could hear them through the megaphone, keep your gloves off, put your hands on the car. And for an hour, they had me back there till my hands were getting literally frostbitten. So if I go out, even in cold weather here in California at night, when it's in, you know, the high 30s, that frostbite will act up and I still get numb from it.
You know, a lot of your book is very centered on like anti-racist organizing and you know, building common cause with Blacks and Latinos. Vietnam vets is a big part of it. When you were in Kenosha, you know, one of the stories is about how you interacted with another worker, dead-eyed Dave Marino, who was also seemed to be affiliated with the Klan. I think also in that chapter you talk about a union march which was being counter-protested by the Klan. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of, you know, I actually think an important part about organizing is actually meeting people where they're at and not just talking to people you agree with. And so I'm just wondering if you could talk about Deadeye Dave Marino and that sort of like approach to organize.
Yeah, I mean, you're making a really good point because, you know, young people are still learning, but I've met young people who kind of think that their job is to go into the plant and kind of lecture workers about socialism. And that's not your starting point. I mean, people, you know, that's not what's essential to people's daily lives.
That's their approach more than just in the factory. That happens everywhere, as far as I can tell.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So a call had been issued by an organization called the United League of Mississippi that were organizing around Mississippi, particularly in Tupelo. And the Klan had become recently active again. And the United League was trying to, had a couple organizing points. Stop the theft of Black land, because there were literally tens of thousands of acres of Black farmland that had been stolen by the government or mortgage companies, and Black farmers were just losing their land. The second issue was the demand that there be more Black employees in Tupelo in the white businesses. And lastly, there was to stop police and Klan attacks on Black people. And they asked people to come join on a, I think it was a Labor Day weekend, a march against the Klan. So we put out a flyer, about 6,000 flyers, because it was a big factory, calling on people to join us in getting on the bus to go down and oppose the Klan. Well, you know, I mean, I got to be honest, Kenosha had its section of pretty redneck workers. You know, there were a lot of guys who farmed during the day and worked second shift, and they tended to be more conservative. I mean, they're the kind of guy that stereotypically had a pickup truck with a rack on the back, you know, with a hunting rifle. And, but, you know, you got to talk to them about, you know, you're going down to march against the Klan, because you got to try and unite with them on the day-to-day fight in the factory, but also bring up these issues. Like you say, we were, one of our main planks was fighting racism. I mean, there was probably not an issue of Fighting Times that didn't have an article or a call to action to fight for a Black worker who had been discharged. The one time there were three Black workers drinking beer out in the parking lot in their car, and they were fired, and we started a petition, got them rehired. So that was part of our daily practice, really. And it was very important because, you know, we really had a strong base of support among Black workers and women workers, because we did the same. We didn't allow any acts of, you know, sexism or misogyny from the company toward women. And there were many, you know, I mean, it feels now like it was the days of the suffragettes trying to get the right to vote, the way those some of those supervisors acted toward women, you know, going around and all, promising them better jobs if they'd sleep with them. And we'd expose it right in the pages of Fighting Times. So, you know, among women and Blacks, we really had a lot of support. But so we put out this flyer, and we had a busload of people that went down to Tupelo. And it was the first time I'd ever been south, even though I grew up in Washington, D.C. in the 50s, which was felt like a southern city. But this was the deep south. And the bus pulls up, and I look out to the right when we're getting off, and it's the Tupelo Police Department. And out come 20 guys wearing white hoods, full Klan paraphernalia, and they're all cops. They walk out of the police station, and they're got axe handles in their hands. There's a picture in my book, by the way, for people who want to check it out. My book is Fighting Times, Organizing on the Front Lines of the Class War, and it's for sale on pmpress.org. And it's, we've put it on 50% discount because we want to make it available to everybody. So if you put in the code FIGHTING in capital letters, you'll get it very inexpensively. So that's on pmpress.org. But going back to getting out and seeing these Klan members, I'm saying to myself, well, I mean, who do we call if they attack us with these axe handles and there's pistols in their pockets? You know, you can't call 911 and say, hey, we're being attacked by the Klan, because that they are the cops. So
the Blue Klux Klan.
Yeah, exactly. exactly. So one of the things that had changed the scales of justice, I'd say, was I walked up to the front of the march, which was all being led by young Black guys. And I looked into the bed of a pickup truck that was leading the march, and it was just loaded with weapons, long guns, M1 carbines. And after Vietnam, Black workers, they weren't going to take it anymore. You know, they had been fighting in the jungles. You know, they knew how to fight. They knew how to stand up and, as you know, stand up for their rights. And it was kind of like that, I forget the expression, nuclear deterrent, because it's mutually destructive. You know, if either side went after either side, we're all going out in a blaze of glory. So, you know, it was a wild march. I mean, seeing so many good old boys carrying their rifles, just lining the streets, yelling at us. And it was, you know, an eye opener. But when we got back, the incident you referred to, I was sitting in a bar after work where we did a lot of good organizing. And the guy next to me, I didn't know him, and I felt something sticking in my side. And I looked down and it was a 38. And he said, my name's Deadeye DeMarino. I'm a member of the White People's National Socialist Party. And I don't like your commie radical ass or your Fighting Times newsletter. And, you know, I'm sort of like, what do you do now? And I, bartender, you know, double shots for both of us. We did those. I did them real quick and said, you know, another round. We did those real quick. So then we started talking. I said, look, Deadeye, you're right. I put out the Fighting Times, but aren't you in the maintenance department, the guys who drive the fork trucks? He says, yeah. I says, wasn't there a sit down 2 months ago and there was a steward fired? And wasn't there an article on the front page of Fighting Times demanding that he get his job back? He goes, yeah, that's true. And when you guys had a slowdown and you parked your forklifts in the aisle and wouldn't work, wasn't it the Fighting Times people that came out to support you? Yeah, you're right. And meanwhile, we kept doing double shots. And after about 2 hours, he was like, you know what? You're my brother in the union. You know, forget all that other shit for now. You know, I don't got a beef with you. You know, we're union brothers. And he never again, for the rest of the time that I was there, ever said anything negative at the gate. He'd always give me a nod. You know, he wasn't going to be a guy. We used to have 20 or 30 people that would stop to hand out the newsletter, Fighting Times. It was like a movement more than just a newsletter. You know, it really was a lesson. And it really upsets me when you hear reference to Hillary Clinton making the statement basket of deplorables, because she's really talking about the working class. And that's why Trump has had a successful appeal, because he goes out and tries to appeal to those deplorables, you know, on the issues that, you know, really concern them. And that's, you know, my friends were still working. I don't, you know, this was hard to believe they could do it, but they were in the union and they got themselves to organize for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And they called back and they said, look, we're in Wisconsin. We're organizing union members to vote. We need Hillary to come out here and speak. It's a close race. What did they do? They sent out Chelsea, her daughter. Well, what working class guy wants to listen to some young white girl who went to Barnard or one of these Ivy League women's school? You know, so that did nothing. And then Hillary Clinton lost by only a couple 10,000 of votes. It probably would have tipped it. But when the Democrats have this idea that the working class are all a bunch of dumb, you know, hillbilly rednecks, and, you know, that just isn't true. And in my life's experience, I know it's not true.
You kind of answered my question that I had down here, which is because I'm from the Youngstown, Ohio area, actually. And, you know, growing up, that was heavy duty, blue collar, labor, union, Democrat. Now it's MAGA, new lives. And again, I remember in 2016, like so many people there were just pissed off because of the Clinton's role in NAFTA. And just that she didn't go to most of them. She didn't spend a lot of time in Ohio, right? Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. She just kind of took them for granted and blew them off. And like the story you told about, drinking, doing doubles, right? I hope it was scotch, but
No,
and that's
cheap whiskey,
cheap whiskey.
bar whiskey.
If you're gonna pay, if you're paying, especially.
That's
But
right.
it's like Scott said earlier about meeting people where they're at. And this is kind of a convoluted question, but I think it's important because I see that. Like there are some of these Trump people are probably unreachable and they are racist and they're nuts and they're QAnon and all that. But a lot of them, I think it's really about this sense, like you said, that the Democrats have abandoned them. There is a really strong anti-elitism strain. And so they look
Yeah.
at somebody like Pelosi, from San Francisco with her Dove bars and her $1 million stock trades and all that. Like how do you go about reaching people who on the surface, are really difficult, and you think, if you support Trump after all this, forget it. But it still seems to me that there are people worth going after and talking to and trying to make this, argument based on kind of class consciousness and solidarity in your material conditions.
Well, I have a really good example for you from my life. But first, I just want to respond to one point that you made, which is it's really going to be important in the future to talk to workers about the environment, which is what Scott's issue is. Because in the UAW, with the introduction of EV cars, electric vehicles, we have a real battle to get workers to understand that even though there'll be less jobs created because it's easier, it takes less, people power to build an electric vehicle, why their lives are so intimately touched by what's going on in the environment. And that's a question of education, So it's great that people like Scott are out there fighting that battle because that's an existential question that we all face. And we've got to get the working class to understand it's an existential question for them, their kids, and their grandkids as well. But here's to me the best example of what you've just asked about, Robert. When I was fired, I went to work at a steel fabrication plant. And it was a steel workers plant, but it was more like your typical business union, very weak union. You never knew who your steward was, even. They were never around. And so I used to hang out on second shift with a bunch of all white guys because it was primarily a white plant. It was out in one of the industrial suburbs of Milwaukee. And they were a pretty racist group of guys. And at first, I kind of made the mistake of always lecturing them about racism. Why are you guys always talking this shit about the N-word? And at one point, one of them got so pissed off and he was called Big Carl. He was about 6'6". We were on bar stools. I'm about 5'5". And he got so angry, he hits me full on with a right hook. And I go flying across the bar floor. But, I said to myself, this isn't working, this luxury shit. You get past it and just, get in there, work hard, show them who you are, hang with them, and bring it up in the course of that work. So there was a contract coming up, and we became the main organizers around the contract. We started a caucus. We put out a flyer, calling for a decent contract. And then we called for everybody to walk out at midnight when the contract expired. So we kind of took the business union by surprise. They were nowhere to be found. And we all walked out and shut the plant down. And our caucus was very active all through the strike, where the union was absent. We collected money for people when they were going to be evicted for rent. We promised if they were going to be evicted, we'd block the police from taking their furniture out. We were the ones that figured out that we could get food, surplus food, which you could get in those days from the government. So we were really seen as kind of leaders of the day-to-day strike. Including this great strategy of making up these tacks, welding them so that they were like, no matter what way they fell on the ground, they had a point coming out. And we'd all rush the picket line when there was a truck coming, and we'd walk by and we'd drop them all on the ground. And there wasn't a truck that made it through without getting a flat tire, and not being able to haul scab-made tanks out of the factory. But all of a sudden, one of the young guys, oh, I. Let me step back. one of the reasons when I said to them, why are you guys so racist, was they explained it to me. And they said, we grew up in juvenile home, because they were really, this was a factory that was kind of like, you know, guys with cars, big muscle cars, big tires, you know. And they said, in juvie, you have to fight for every privilege you get. So the white guys band together, the black guys band together, the Latinos and the Native Americans band together, because if you want to watch your TV show, you got to fight to get the changer, the remote. And if you want to get the extra desserts, you got to fight, and it becomes a racial battle over privileges. So it instills this sense of racial antagonism so deeply, because these are young people. And they said, that's why, you know, because we had to do it. All right. So we put out our first leaflet calling for people to strike, and we get organized, and we're on strike. And the word passes that one of our guys, young white guy, who had a cherry red Trans Am with big wheels, and it had been repossessed in court. And everybody was down. I mean, everybody was on me. Mel Rod, you got us to strike. Now look at what the fuck. Eyebolts lost his car. You know, what are you going to do about it now, big shot? You know, and, you know, I really, you know, tried to figure out, how do you work your way organizationally through that situation so that you can lead people to do something about it? And I came up with the idea, and I said to people, look, let's go picket General Motors, GMAC, General Motors, I don't know, it's the accounting division where you get your loan. And they're just like 3 or 4 miles up the road. So we started organizing, and we brought about 70 people from the steelworkers picket line out in front of GMAC. And we're walking around with a picket line, saying, you know, chanting, you know, we want Eyebolt's keys. We want Eyebolt's keys. On strike, shut it down. And all of a sudden, 2 carloads of black workers drive up, and they're all on strike at the meat cutters plant. There were 8 meat cutters plants in Milwaukee in the old days, strong militant meat cutters union, and they were on strike at the same time. And some people in the RU had organized them to come out and join our picket line to get Eyebolt's car back. So 3 of us marched into the manager's office, and we said, look, dude, you know, you see those people out there? In the next 5 minutes, if we don't come out with Eyebolt's keys, they're going to all be sitting in this office, and you're going to have to call the police to get us out of here. And he's like, well, the judge ordered it, so there's nothing you can do. Nothing I can do. I said, yeah, there is. You can give us the keys. So after about 5 minutes of haggling, he gives us the keys. We walk out. You know, we're dangling the keys, and, you know, everybody's euphoric, you know, because to the guys that worked in that steel plant, the judge was the law. They had all been before the judge, you know, fighting, brawling, you know, drunken driving. So you don't challenge the judge. He's the man. But we did, and we won it. Okay. The next week, we organized 3 carloads of our guys to go join the meat cutters picket line. So here we go, you know, all these white guys. And as we got out of the car and they're walking toward the picket line, I can see they're a little bit nervous. Like, they don't even, when you lived in the industrial suburb and you were white, you never went to downtown Milwaukee. You know, it was like a different world. And so they all join this picket line. The police come to force it open, and we're locking arms with the black meat cutters to try and keep the scabs out. And their consciousness changed, you know. All the work that had been done in the prior year paid off. And interestingly enough, not too long ago, I was going through my old photos, bit of nostalgia, and I had pictures of our May Days. And I found the guys from a pressed steel tank, the steel plant, who even after I left the plant, kept coming to May Days. So their consciousness had really changed, transformed into class consciousness, where they saw themselves as part of a class that had to stand together, and they kept coming out for May Day. So, you know, it can be done, and it's got to be done in the course of building struggle that brings people together with a common interest.
I only had like a wrap-up question. I think Scott and I were on the same line. So I just want to thank you for being here today. This has been fantastic. I think we're going to have you back on, because there's so much more that you've talked about, and
Yeah, we
you have
just
really
scratched the
great.
surface.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually, well, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, this is really cool for me. Like I said, I grew up in kind of a similar era, a little after what you're talking about. But I remember Drum, and I remember Lordstown and all the stuff you're talking about, and that kind of sense of hope for this kind of class consciousness and solidarity. And I guess one of the things I wanted to see, and I think Scott is going to make it more specific, is kind of what you think about what's happening today at places like Amazon and Starbucks, because we're seeing, I think, a fairly nice resurgence. It's not a big, huge union like the UAW or USW or something like that. But what you described is really similar to what I saw. Youngstown had 170,000 people when I was growing up, and now it's about 65.
Yeah.
There's been just such a destruction, a devastation of that area. What you described, I think, is really important. And what you did, and how many positive outcomes you had, which I think is really important. We have to understand we do win some,
Yeah, no, and by the way, let me just say, even though I get discouraged sometimes, when I look at Trump and I look at what's going on in Gaza and I look at, what the Democrats, how they refuse to listen to, so many people out in the streets demanding a ceasefire. But, I'm still very strongly believe that we can make change. And it's even more important today because, the future is really on the line. And, there's a lot, like we were saying, there's a lot more stories and I hope to do come back. But I really want to encourage people to pick up the book because we just scratched the surface today. And all these anecdotes are in the book. Again, it's fighting times. It's on pmpress.org. And, the discount code is fighting in capital letters. But, I work right now with a whole group of people in North Carolina. One of the young guys read my book, got in touch with me. They're organizing a strike at two Daimler Chrysler truck plants and at the Thomasville bus plant. And it's black and white workers joining together, even though there's a lot of racism down there, but it's coming through that joint struggle. And I'm encouraged, I mean, they're going out, those same workers, there's one of the plants that's down the road for them that makes the car, the frames for, I forget if it's the big trucks or what it is, but it's non-union. And they're handing out flyers. Join the UAW. So not only are they threatening to go on strike to win better wages, they're trying to organize the unorganized as part of it. So, you wouldn't believe the number of Amazon workers that have bought the book. I've had a study group with Amazon workers about the book. Starbucks, the same. I work very closely with people from Starbucks Workers United. And I work with independent unions, which I think is something you're referring to, because the CIO was what brought the movement in the 30s to the peak of where it was. And today I'm finding so many young people that want to organize independently at Trader Joe's, at New Seasons Groceries, at other coffee chains. And we're going to be at Labor
And
Notes.
Dartmouth basketball players
Is that
yesterday.
true?
Yeah, Dartmouth basketball players with the United States.
Well, I mean, that's see, it's so, I mean, all new sectors that never organized, bank tellers, I read at Wells Fargo. So, I mean, there is a union spirit and there is a militant spirit. And there's also how fast this movement grew up against the imperialism going on with the Israelis in Palestine is really inspirational because it took us at the Vietnam War many years before we got as many people active and conscious as this time around with the Palestine situation. So, I'm just always, I enjoy working with young people and I'm continuing to do that.
I mean, in some ways, I think that the Israeli genocide in Palestine, it was the movement was just waiting for a moment like that. After 2020, after all the sort of youth-led uprisings we've seen around Black Lives Matter, and actually increasingly, like you're saying, with labor, particularly Starbucks Workers United and the Amazon unions and things like that. And so it was this sort of moment that it was like a powder keg waiting to happen, I guess you could say. My only other question is something we'd actually talked about before the show started was, we've been seeing this deindustrialization and like what's called the Rust Belt states. I'm wondering if you could just actually tell our audience really quickly about what happened with the AMC factories in Milwaukee and Kenosha, where they are now, and how that has been had this devastating effect on, you know, middle class, working class power in that area.
Yeah, I mean, it's really such an important question. You know, in Milwaukee, just about every single factory was union, you know, and it's why Milwaukee, you know, I don't like to use the word middle class because I don't think it's really, you know, explains very well working people. But for the moment of this discussion, people had a middle class life. I mean, most people who worked at American Motors had a little cottage on a lake in Wisconsin. They had a pontoon boat. They'd go up there on the weekends. You know, in terms of the Black community, one of the main organizers with me, a guy named Jimmy Graham, who came to my book launch this many years later. God, I left in 85. He became a steward with me when I was chief steward. And his two kids became doctors, you know, and went to college. Those opportunities are gone. You know, in Milwaukee, yeah, you know, it's just gone. It's like a ghost town. The old American Motors plant is a big box store, you know. And, you know, what for people like us, organizers, I think we've got to win a lot of people to understanding that America is still an industrial power. It's still America and China, United States and China, as the two industrial powers. But it's moved. It's in the South. It's in the Southeast. And that's why I really feel it's important working with these guys in North Carolina, because we've got to be down there organizing. That's where the huge, you know, Toyota plants are and the Mercedes-Benz plants are, all of which are organizing for the first time.
And that's part of UAW's sort of like post-strike last year strategy as well.
Right. The victory of the UAW in that strike has really unleashed a movement, grassroots movement. It's not the UAW sending in people to like open an office near the factory and try and convince people. No, it's people in those shops coming forward and telling the UAW, we formed an organizing committee and we want to work with, you know, get the backing of the UAW. I mean, right here down the road from us is the Tesla plant. Mm-hmm. They're hiring. I called up. If I was 30 years younger, you know, I mean, what could be better than waking up every day and fucking with Elon Musk? You know, but, you know, so.
We should organize Twitter workers, too.
Well, they really, yeah. I mean, I'm sure they wish they had organized after the decimation that he brought on that company.
Yeah.
Thanks again. And, you know, like I said, given where I grew up and everything, your stories really are illuminating and kind of bring me back to an earlier time. And let's hope that there's a resurgence in the kind of radicalism and activism that you described.
So. Yeah. And we definitely want to have you back on to talk about, even if we're talking about like current labor developments or something like that. Folks, we've been talking with Jonathan Melrod, who's the author of Fighting Times. Jonathan, you want to tell people where they can get the book again?
Yeah. If you go to just pmpress.org and put in Fighting Times, it'll take you to the link. And if you add the word fighting in capital letters, you'll get it for 50% off. So it's very affordable. And I think most people who've read it have really just come back with positive comments and feel like there's a lot of inspiration there and a lot of lessons, day-to-day concrete lessons. And I really want to thank you guys for taking the time to put me on, to interview me. And, you know, hopefully I'll get you the link and we'll be able to put it up on social media so a lot more people get to hear it.
Yeah, totally.
It was really great. You know, while you were talking, reminded me of the great Stockton Lynn, because we've had conversations with him like this. So it's encouraging that there are people out there who are still kind of carrying that torch. So thanks for all you've done.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Folks, if you want to check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, if you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. Or if you want to make a donation, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button, or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And then we also have swag. It's too bad Jonathan got off, or we could probably get him a hat. You can get a green and red trucker hat for $25. Just send us an email at greenredpodcast@gmail and make a donation of $25. Or you can also get a copy of Bob's first book, which is called Masters of War, for a $35 donation. Same principle applies. Email us at greenredpodcast@gmail.
Cy Hirsch blurbed it.
And we'll get you a copy of that as well. But for everybody else out there, just misbehave and make lots of trouble. And we will talk to you again real soon.